Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his work in vain. God is his own interpreter, and he will make it plain. You are holy, Lord. Your ways are not our ways. You are holy, Lord. Your thoughts are not our thoughts. Those two songs that we have just sung together help us to have a right frame of mind as we approach the scriptures, as well as the way that we seek to understand God's providence in our own lives. We need to remember that God's ways are not our ways, that his thoughts are not our thoughts. We need to remember that with our own finite understanding and our own limited experience, if we seek to comprehend God's dealings in his word and in this world by our own wisdom, we are almost certain to come up with the wrong explanations. We need to go to God. We need to go to his word. We need to allow him to deal with us and in this world according to his wisdom and in his time and by his methods to make known his will to us. That must certainly be true of the passage that is before us for our study this evening in this 25th chapter of the book of Genesis, and the second half of the chapter, verses 19 through 34. The story itself, I guess, is familiar enough to most of us, if not all of us here this evening. The story of the birth of Esau and of Jacob to Isaac and Rebekah, and the selling of the birthright. We're highlighted with the fact that this is a new chapter in the unfolding history of God's providence in this world. Those opening words of verse 19 inform us of that. These are the generations of Isaac. We've noted before that in the book of Genesis they are used as a flag for us, telling us now we're on to a new episode, a new chapter, a new way in which God is dealing in the lives of the people of this world to bring about his purposes in this world. And so we're given this opening to a new episode. Abraham fathered Isaac. There's such similar words to those found in verse 12, aren't they? These are the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son. But here we don't have the added explanation that verse 12 offers, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's servant, bore to Abraham. No, we just simply go into the fact that Abraham fathered Isaac. We don't need the extra explanation because Isaac is the true son of promise to Abraham. The extra explanation is needed in the case of Ishmael. He is not the son of Sarah. He is not the son of promise. He is not the son of the inheritance. He is not the son of the chosen line through which God has promised to bless Abraham, to bless his descendants, and indeed to bless the whole world. Now that is to be done through Isaac, whom Abraham fathers. Isaac, we have already noted, has in the providence of God been provided with a wife. Rebekah is her name. She is the daughter of Abraham's relatives in Paddan Aram. Very carefully, Abraham has sought to ensure that Isaac doesn't marry a Canaanite bride from the land that he will inherit, but gains a wife from his family back in Paddan Aram. We notice that a very similar unfolding in the story of the life of Isaac as that of Abraham. The time scales tend to be shortened and abbreviated, but nevertheless, similar events unfold, and we discover that Rebekah is barren, just as Sarah was. Now, this is an interesting thing because, as you may recall, the relatives of Abraham, in blessing their sister and daughter, said, our sister, may you become thousands of 10,000s, and may your offspring possess the gate of those who hate them. A blessing that is no doubt based on what the servant of Abraham had told them of God's blessing upon Abraham. God had prospered Abraham. God was a wealthy man, highly respected in the land of promise. He had also been greatly blessed by God with the promise of an inheritance, with the promise of nations coming forth from his loins. And so this blessing pronounced by Rebekah's relatives is built upon the knowledge of the promise that God was going to make of Abraham, and therefore of Isaac, a great nation, and all the nations of the earth would be blessed through this offspring. And so there is an expectation of fulfillment. But nevertheless, Rebekah is barren. What a puzzling outcome. No doubt, as Isaac took Rebekah as his wife, there was an expectation of immediacy in the fulfillment of the promises. But that was not to be. Year was to pass after year, decade after decade, in fact. 20 years are to pass. 40 years old Isaac is when he took Rebekah to be his wife. 60 years old when a son is finally born to them. And that son comes as the result of prayer. The prayer of Isaac for his wife because she is barren. A prayer of faith. A prayer that is founded upon the promises of God to Abraham. There is no indication here of desperation, but rather a suggestion of confidence. And yet the years pass. At what point does Isaac begin to pray for his wife? Have 10 years passed? 20? No, indeed, the idea being conveyed here is that there was an ongoing prayerfulness with Isaac. He expected his wife to bear a child. And the years pass and no child is born. And he prays over and over and over, persistently, even as his own father has taught him to pray, with persistence, pleading with God to be loyal and faithful and true to the promises that he has been made. The Hebrew, in fact, could be translated, Isaac prayed in front of his wife, with the suggestion that each time they came together, the prayer on Abraham, on Isaac's mind was, Lord God, this time, provide a child, provide the heir of promise. This time, fulfill your promises to my father and to me. This time, may Rebekah conceive and bear a son. And ultimately, God answers that prayer. God grants the request. And Rebekah conceives. But still it's not all plain sailing. For as the child grows within her, we're told that there was a movement that was unnatural within her womb. Of course, at this point, though in our narrative we understand that there is more than one child there, she possibly doesn't know that. The children, we're told, struggle together within her, and she says, "If it is thus, why is this happening to me?" The idea is that there is such a strange phenomenon going on inside her that she even wishes that she weren't alive, which is suggested in the alternative translation in the footnote of the ESV. Why do I live? Yeah, this isn't just the kicking movement of a baby in the womb. There is something unnatural about what is going on here, such that Rebecca is puzzled, and indeed the force of the original is that there is a battle going on in her womb that puzzles her. What is going on here? And so she goes and she inquires of the Lord. She asks the Lord for an explanation of what is going on. And no doubt even the explanation initially is a puzzle to her. Two nations, she is told, are in your womb. Two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. There is a hint here of a mysterious, strange providence of God that will be worked out in the lives of the children that will be born to Rebecca. And indeed, when the fullness of time comes and she gives birth, behold, there were twins in her womb. These then are the two nations that were striving, that were battling, even inside her. A foretaste of the enmity that would exist between brother and brother, and indeed in the centuries to follow, between nation and nation, that were derived from them. The one son comes out all red, not necessarily the colour of his hair. It's the same word that is used to describe David, King David, ruddy, handsome. But all his body is like a hairy cloak. One commentator suggests that he probably suffered from a condition called hypertrichosis, or more commonly known as werewolf syndrome, in which his body is literally covered with hair, which explains for us perhaps the situation that arises later on. You know the story where Jacob puts on the skins of a goat in order to mimic the appearance of his brother, so that Isaac in his blindness is fooled. Now, to our minds, that seems strange. The skin of a goat, how could that in any degree resemble the skin of a man? Well, if you're suffering from werewolf syndrome, it might well mimic what your skin condition would be like. Literally, covered in hair. Google it and you'll see some pictures. This was his condition. And they called his name Esau. And then his brother came out. And the battle isn't over, you see. Even as the one son is born, the other grasps hold of his heel and is drawn out with him. And so it will be throughout their lives. And such is the indication of the kind of man that Jacob is to be. A grasping, manipulative man. 20 years, and God has answered the prayer, but in such a strange way, with such strange children. And these boys grow up and they're demonstrated to be markedly different, not only in their physical appearance, but also in their personalities. Esau is a man of the field. He's a hunter. He's an outdoorsman. He's bold. He's brave. He's strong. He's adventurous. He's masculine. While Jacob is a quiet man, a peace-loving man, a man who dwells in the tents. He likes to cook. Isaac loves Esau. He loves him as a dog loves its owner for the food that is provided. That's literally the force of the Hebrew here. Isaac loved Esau because he ate his game, because he was a hunter and he brought in what Isaac liked to eat. Rebekah loved Jacob. No explanation is given as to why she loves him more than Esau. But though there is striving, while there is striving between Esau and Jacob, there is also this difference of love and favoritism with Isaac and Rebekah too. And the story goes on with an episode from the lives of these men, presumably in their relative youth. As Jacob is at home cooking a stew, Esau comes in from the field. And again, it's a familiar story to us. Esau's exhausted from his exertions hunting the game. He obviously comes home fruitless in his endeavours. As successful as a hunter as he may be this time, he comes home empty-handed. He sees what Jacob is cooking and he wants it. His mouth is salivating as he comes towards the camp and smells the odour of this stew. And in his rough and ready way, he comes up to Jacob, and not in the polite sense that our English versions tend to translate it, "Let me have some of that red stew." He rather comes in demanding it. "Give me that red stew, I'm exhausted." And Jacob, well, he sees an opportunity here. He may be a quiet man, he may love the peace of home, but he's also a schemer. He knows what he wants. He's an intelligent man and he knows how to get it. And he sees in this an opportunity for him to take full advantage of his older brother and to take from him something that was his by right of his being the firstborn. In that era, in that age, the firstborn had a greater right to the inheritance and to blessing. There is a birthright that belonged to the eldest. And so Jacob takes the opportunity to snatch this from Esau. He tells him, "Well, you sell me your birthright and you do it now. Let's waste no time about this. You want this stew, I want your birthright. Let's trade." And Esau's unthinking response is, "Well, I'm about to die. What use is it to me? I don't care about the birthright. I care about my belly." And so Jacob agrees, but he makes sure of this transaction. "Swear to me now. Swear an oath," he says. "Let's make this a concrete deal." And so he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. And so Jacob gave him the bread and the lentil stew. He ate, he drank, he rose, he went. And thus Esau despised his birthright. Well, these two men don't provide us with a picture of people that are to be emulated. Not either one of them. But there are things that we can draw out from this story. One of the great themes of the book of Genesis is that of beginnings. It means beginning. But also throughout this book is an emphasis on the sovereignty of God. And we see it demonstrated in this passage. Indeed, this passage, verses 19 through 34 of chapter 25, is kind of introductory to the lives of Jacob and of Esau. It sort of prepares us for what is to follow in the ensuing chapters that talk about their lives. It gives us a glimpse into the kind of men that they are and the way that God will work through them to bring about his purposes. But notice three particular things in which we see the sovereignty of God. Firstly, we see the sovereign faithfulness of God. We see the sovereign faithfulness of God. We see that in the fact that Rebekah is eventually granted conception. She brings forth these two sons. God has promised to Abraham that he will make of him a nation, a great nation. He has promised that that will be through Isaac, that he is the son of promise. The promise is reiterated to Isaac. And Isaac then faces this situation in which he and his wife are childless, just as his father and mother had been childless. Now, he has the experience of his father and mother to learn from, and so he doesn't fall into the same trap as they had done. He doesn't get a concubine. He doesn't think that the son of promise will come through that legal arrangement. He realizes that if God's promise is to be fulfilled, it will be through Rebekah. And so the years pass and he prays, and eventually God answers prayer. But the point to learn from this is that in God's faithfulness, God is sovereign. That when God determines that he will work out a certain plan and purpose, he does it his way. And he does it in his time. And we can think in our own minds, oh well, God has made this promise, therefore this and this and this will happen. And no doubt that was the case for Isaac and Rebekah when they first got married. God has made a promise, we will have children, the promise will be fulfilled, and it will all be simple and straightforward. But it wasn't. And we often find that that is the case in our lives. That there are certain promises that God gives us in his word, but the way that he works them out in our lives are mysterious to us. They confound us at times. They cause us to have all kinds of questions in our minds. Why is this happening to me, Lord? This doesn't seem to fit your promises in your word. And God calls us to trust him, as he called Isaac and Rebekah to trust him year after year after year of barrenness. The silent message comes, trust me, trust me, trust me. I have demonstrated my faithfulness in the life of your father. Trust me. Keep trusting me, keep praying to me. I'll answer your prayer, but trust me in the meantime. We get an echo of that in the New Testament when Peter, in his second letter, chapter 3, and verse 9 says, it's different context admittedly, but the same lesson nevertheless, the Lord is not slow to fulfill his promise as some count slowness, but is patient toward you, not wishing that any should perish, but that all should reach repentance. Now, in that context, the idea is that of salvation and of judgment and the end of the world being delayed in order that the fullness of the chosen people of God should be brought in. But nevertheless, there is that emphasis on God's determination to do things in his time according to his will for our greatest good and benefit. And this is what is happening here. We see in this the sovereign faithfulness of God. God is faithful. We must never doubt the faithfulness of God in whatever circumstances we may find ourselves in. God is faithful, but he is also sovereign. In other words, he's not at our beck and call. He doesn't have to respond to our demands, as some segments of the church seem to teach, that we can claim any promise from God and he is duty-bound to give it now, as soon as I demand it. No, God doesn't work like that. God works in his way, by his time. We see then in this story the sovereign faithfulness of God. Secondly, we see the sovereign election of God. Here is this battle going on in the womb of Rebekah. And she's puzzled by it. It's causing her probably significant pain and anguish. She thinks there must be something wrong. And so when she inquires of the Lord, the response of the Lord to her is this: two nations are in your womb. Two peoples from within you shall be divided. The one shall be stronger than the other. The older shall serve the younger. God is sovereignly working. Even as these two are in the womb of Rebekah, he's working out his purposes. And his purposes involve a choice. A choice that Jacob, the younger, will be the heir of the promise, and that Esau, the older, will be rejected. That is God's sovereign choice. He predicts it before these boys are even born. It's not the first time we've seen God's sovereignty in election at work. We saw it with God choosing Abram out of Ur of the Chaldeans. Why didn't he choose any of the other men there? Was Abraham more godly? Was he more inclined to respond? Well, there's no suggestion of that in the text at all. It's simply that that was God's choice. And so that is God's choice here. And then the Apostle Paul gives us a commentary on this text in his letter to the church in Rome, where in the 9th chapter of Romans and verses 10 through 13, he makes reference to this episode, and he says in chapter 9 of Romans, verses 10 through 13, "When Rebekah had conceived children by one man, our forefather Isaac, though they were not yet born and had done nothing either good or bad, in order that God's purpose of election might continue, not because of works, but because of his call, she was told, 'The older will serve the younger.' As it is written, 'Jacob I loved, but Esau I hated.'" Now that latter reference is from the prophecy of Malachi, and the reference to God's loving Jacob and hating Esau shouldn't be taken in absolute terms. Jesus himself says that we are to hate father and mother and brother and sister and son or daughter in comparison to our love for him. Now we know elsewhere that we are to love father and mother. We're to love our children. We're to love our brothers and sisters. There is no contradiction. It's a comparison that is being made. In comparison to the greatness of our love for Christ, it would seem as though we hate our closest relatives, And this is the sense of what is being said here. Jacob I loved, Esau I hated. This is demonstrated in the fact that he chose Jacob, he rejected Esau. This was all part of God's sovereign election. Why did he do it? He doesn't tell us. This was his choice. It was his prerogative. What he does emphatically state is that it wasn't for anything meritorious in either one or the other of these men. It wasn't because Jacob was better than Esau before either of them had done good or bad. Not because of works, but simply on the basis of his call, Rebekah was told, the older will serve the younger. I have chosen Jacob. I have rejected Esau. Jacob will be the recipient, the heir of the promise. Through him, I will make of Abraham a great nation. Through him, all the nations of the world will be blessed. And quite on the contrary of Esau receiving any blessing, he becomes a thorn in the side of Jacob and Israel for generations to come. So we see in this passage God's sovereign faithfulness. We see in this passage God's sovereign election. And finally, we see in this passage God's sovereign providence. God's sovereign providence. The story of Esau coming in from the field, famished and demanding a meal from his brother. The story of Jacob's subtlety in stealing from his brother the birthright in this trade that he makes, selling some stew for the inheritance and blessing. This is interpreted in the scriptures as the means by which God works to fulfill his purposes in the lives of these men, but more significantly in the history of Israel and in the redemption of his people. God uses this episode in order to ensure that Jacob does become the leader over Esau. That what was predicted to Rebekah concerning the one being stronger than the other and the older serving the younger should actually come to pass. God is sovereignly at work in all of this. And yet it is Jacob and Esau who are acting out this play, as it were. It is their choices that are being made. It's not that they are puppets on a string, but nevertheless, God in his sovereign providence is working out his purposes. And we see that in the life of Esau, in the choices that he makes, he demonstrates that he is not an appropriate recipient of the promises. And however cunning and deceitful Jacob may be, there is nevertheless a hint that he understands the significance of what is going on. In Hebrews chapter 12 and verses 15 and 17, the writer gives us a commentary on this episode when he says, "See to it that no one fails to obtain the grace of God, that no root of bitterness springs up and causes trouble, and by it many become defiled, that no one is sexually immoral or unholy like Esau." How was Esau's unholiness expressed? "Who sold his birthright for a single meal. For you know that afterward, when he desired to inherit the blessing, he was rejected, for he found no chance to repent, though he sought it with tears. He despised the birthright, and he lost the blessing. It was all because he was unholy. He didn't understand the significance of these things. He was careless about the significance of these things. He lived for the moment. He lived for the day. He lived for the adventure of the chase. He lived for the praise of his father. He lived for the hot meal that would be served at the end of a hard day's work. He lived for the accomplishments that he could achieve. He lived for himself. And it didn't matter about the future. It didn't matter about the promises. It didn't matter about the descendants. It didn't matter about the blessing. Because what mattered was today. What mattered was how he felt now, at this moment. And he demonstrated that he was unholy, that he was not a man who understood God's purposes and plans or had any interest in them whatsoever. And God uses that to sovereignly bring about his purposes for Israel and for the nations of this world. These two men, they're a study in contrasts, aren't they? From the moment that they appear in this world, the differences in their physiques, the differences in their personalities as they grow up, they're a study in contrasts, but also in their similarities. In some ways, Esau is the more likable of these two men. He's down to earth. What you see is what you get with Esau. He's also, it seems to me, a very generous man. He's high-spirited and he's vengeful at first. He doesn't take Jacob's stealing of the birthright or the blessing very well, does he? Well, understandably so. Threatens to kill him. Jacob has to run off, flee for his life. But when they eventually come back together, Esau embraces his brother. There seems to be a full and frank forgiveness there. Jacob comes back, sending before him peace offerings, trying to ply his brother for fear of his reaction. And the gifts that he offers are rich gifts, generous gifts. And Esau turns them all down. I don't need them. You keep them for yourself, he says. No, I think in many ways, Esau's a more likable man than this scheming, double-tongued Jacob. You never know whether you can trust this one. You see, in their different ways, these two men demonstrate a great similarity. They are both sinners. To the core of their hearts, these men are both sinners. And so what is it that makes the difference in their lives? The grace of God. That's all. The grace of God. The grace of God transforms Jacob. The grace of God uses the strengths of Jacob, which also happen to be his weaknesses, to transform him into a man who is loyal and faithful and determined and enduring. And a man who appreciates the promises of God given to Abraham and to Isaac. The problem with Esau, more than anything else, was the fact that he despised his birthright. He didn't care about the promises of God, in other words. He was unholy in respect to God's promises. Whereas Jacob, despite his obvious sinfulness, and despite the fact that I think many of us, if we were to have met these two men, would probably have found Jacob the less likable of them, nevertheless, he is the one that God chooses and God transforms, that God makes holy by his grace. Here then are the sons of Isaac. It is the sovereign faithfulness, the sovereign election, and the sovereign providence of God that transforms the life of one into a patriarch for whom we are all thankful, and allows the life of the other to be one of enmity against God. It is the sovereign faithfulness and the sovereign election and the sovereign providence of God at work in our lives that makes the difference. And the question that we must ask is, how do we respond to God? How do we respond to his promises? How do we respond to his providences in our lives? Do we despise him? Criticize him? Are we indifferent to him? Then we demonstrate that we have the heart of Esau. Or are we open to him? Are we determined by whatever means to understand and grapple with his providences and to get a blessing from him? Then we have the heart of Jacob. Are we unholy or holy? Set apart for God or set apart from God? Only our response to God's dealings with our lives will demonstrate what heart we have. May God enable each one of us by his grace to be like Jacob rather than like Esau.